Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Mark Barrowcliffe's memoir, The Elfish Gene, recounts the author's misspent youth. Happily, this particular youth was misspent in an entertaining way, or at least Barrowcliffe's recollection of the experience is entertaining. And no wonder. It's full of wizards, dragons, and weapons as wondrous as any 12-year-old boy could imagine. That's because Mark Barrowcliffe spent much of his adolescence wandering in the depths and hollows of a fantasy game called Dungeons & Dragons, an activity he characterizes as unprecedented in human history because it's a story you can listen to at the same time you're telling it. When he joined me earlier this week from the studios of the BBC in Brighton, England, I asked Mark Barrowcliffe to explain how that worked.
Well, briefly, it's a kind of narrative story. The best way of describing it I've come up with is that it's like one of these World of Warcraft games or something like that. Computer games before they had computers. So where in the computer game you'll see a generated image, in Dungeons and Dragons you'll have that scene described to you by someone who's gone through beforehand and designed this entire world according to a set of rules. So he'll say you're standing before a heavily embossed wooden door, lights pouring out from under it. What do you do? Well, we send our thief to the door, a specialist thief, and he listens. Well, he can hear the sounds of goblins talking behind. Okay, we all draw our swords, bash down the door, in we go. And then there's a set of rules. Girls love this stuff, believe me. There's a set of rules which determine, you know, how you fight the goblins. In fact, there's a set of rules that determine everything from your hair color to the weight of the rations that you're eating. So it's a fantasy world delineated in pen, paper, and the imagination rather than a fantasy world delineated in computer bytes.
The boys inclined to be fascinated by such things as imaginary wizards, mysterious fireballs, dungeon-dwelling monsters of various kinds, they tend to find other similarly obsessed dweebs. This is your word for that group. But of your early Dungeons & Dragons days, you write that you were too nerdy even for the dweebs. That must have been a discouraging discovery.
Well, it was terrible at the time because I was actually ostracized by my group. But in my small defense, there's not much in my defense, but in my defense, I was just nearly 12. And a lot of the guys I was playing with were nearly 15 or 15. And that's a big difference. And I was an immature 12-year-old. And to be fair to them, they were immature 15-year-olds. but we were both, you know, I was probably had a mental age around 8 and they probably had a mental age around 12. I mean, the game was all my dreams come true. I'd been a major fantasy nut as a kid growing up. Read The Hobbit until the words came off the page, and I'd been into things like Ursula Le Guin's A Wizard of Earthsea, all that kind of stuff. And to be able to act all that out was just terrific to me. And unfortunately, I did actually act it out. Why call on the ancient powers to smite thee down, sir? You know, just roll the dice and shut up, Mark. You know, it's like these guys who play this game, a lot of us anyway, not everybody, but those of us who are real obsessives, were obsessed with kind of sophistication. And as with a lot of human behavior, liking D&D is a way of feeling better than other people, i.e. we have this secret code, we have this secret world which you jock know nothing about, and you know, if only you were more intelligent you would like it too, and you'd stop that gym class because you know that this was much more important. That's how we felt, important.
Among your fellow players, the one who struck me as most remarkable was Billy Crowbraugh. I hope I've pronounced that correctly.
Well, you've pronounced it correctly in American terms. It's Billy Crowbraugh.
Crowbraugh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you first met him and the impression that he made on you.
Well, Billy, as I say in the book, in Dungeons & Dragons, the dragons are powerful sorcerers in their own right, and they're capable of taking any form they choose, you know, from a small child to a plant even. And Billy looked to me exactly like a golden dragon would have looked had he decided to appear as an extremely overweight schoolboy. He had a kind of bright plume of yellow hair. He was very, very fat, very expansive in his way of talking, smoked cigarette after cigarette, you know, at age 15 he just smoked one off the other, and could quote everything from Shakespeare to physics, chemistry. I mean, he seemed At the time, to me, he was easily the brightest and most impressive person I'd ever met. The one thing Billy wasn't showing off about was his intelligence. He may have had pretensions to being into heavy metal, he may have had pretensions to a lot of things, but Billy was genuinely extremely bright. And he, you know, when I first met him, he was sitting in a war games club smoking away. And I, you know, I said, "Oh, can I sit next to you?" And the first thing he said to me was, "Sit down betwixt the wind and his nobility," and let out this enormous fart. This is typical of Billy. It's not just something he trotted out. The guy sitting next to him was, he wasn't upper class. He was very middle class. And when I was growing up in England, your class was an absolutely defining factor of who you were. And so, yeah, he says, "Sit down betwixt the wind and his nobility," to this posh kid. And then, you know, as I say, proceeds to sort of pepper his conversation with Shakespeare and calls for more food, really. That's the, he did remind me of a kind of, had I known about Falstaff at that age, he would have reminded me of Falstaff.
I was going to say, he sounds genuinely Falstaffian, yeah.
Well, that's what he says in the book. One of the other guys says, "You're Falstaffian, Billy," and he said, "No, I was indeed Falstaff. You're incorrect there, because they they put on Henry IV for me so I could take the role in the school play," which they did. And I got the feeling he could have done anything really in his life, almost anything, other than meet a girl. I mean, to his he was always fat, very fat, and that was unusual in England in the 1970s, very unusual. And I think that kind of obviously gave him pause with girls, really.
Well, we need to get into this whole issue of girls and their absence in the Dungeons and Dragons world.
You say that wrong. If you're going to say girls, as we would have said it when we were D&Ders at that age, you have to say it like this. You have to say, "Girls!"
I don't think I can do it. I'm going to count on you for that.
Yeah. And then you have to go absolutely bright red and put your hand up to your forehead and hide your eyes,
kind of thing.
Which is how I used to react to the presence of my friend's sisters very often.
Well, you write of yourself in those Dungeons & Dragons days that you were, quote, "a bullied, power-hungry twerp with no discernible skill in conventional fields and no immediate hope of a girlfriend who wasn't mentally ill." This must have been weird terrain for you to revisit in writing the book.
Yeah, I think I got a little easy on myself there, actually. Not really, because, you know, always compare yourself to the greats. This is my advice. Bob Dylan said that he listens to Blowing in the Wind and cannot at all relate to the person who wrote that nowadays. And I feel the same about my 12-year-old self. I look back and I just think, oh, God, I wish I was me now. You know, I would have just changed so much. You know, I kind of, for a start, relax. The second, the first time someone says anything sarcastic to you at school, hit them with something. You know, then you don't have to ever do it again, as opposed to spending your life skulking from pillar to post, being chased by lunatics, which is what I spent most of my youth doing.
In the most tense moment of an actual Dungeons & Dragons game described in the book, you write of a confrontation between Billy Crowborough and a boy named Andy Porter, who'd been something of a real-life troll toward you, though you admired him enormously. What happened on that fateful day?
Well, Dungeons & Dragons, were, as all games do, work as a forum by which people can work out their frustrations. I mean, I'm sure in normal sports, everybody's aware of the guy who seems perfectly nice until he steps over the touchline and then turns into this kind of terrible screaming werewolf that's got, you know, has this awful will to win, then steps back over the touchline again and is completely nice. Dungeons and Dragons allows people to work out their frustrations and their desires, but it's not got that vent of physical movement. So it's just absolutely in its naked form, these kind of egos butting up against each other. And to cut a long story short, Billy accused Andy Porter of being a liar, of making something up in the game specifically in order to kill his character. Now, that was bad enough, and nobody had ever really said that before. Nobody had ever come out and called anybody to their face a liar. There'd been a lot of insults. I mean, teenage boys routinely call each other by the most foul insults. You know, my nickname was either Spaz or Cretin with the older boys, you know, and that's not unusual for where I grew up at all. But we then went on to do another dungeon, one of my dungeons, in which Andy completely ignored what was going on in the game, the scenario or anything like that, and just had his character attack Billy's character just to get revenge on him for calling him a liar earlier on. And I think at that point, Billy had grown out of this squabbling, because the games had become protracted squabbles between boys over rules, over who said what, where, what went where. And in fact, the game wasn't being played. It was just very often like just sitting down for an argument for 6 hours. So Billy got sick of it and went away. And that was the last I ever saw of him, really, which was a shame. And it's something to do with the way we saw ourselves at that time. We didn't see that we had a friendship which went outside the game. Although we did, we were great friends.
Much of the content of our discussion notwithstanding, several females do appear in The Elfish Gene, even a wife eventually.
Yeah.
To what extent was the discovery of the opposite sex responsible for the end of your days as a fantasy gamer?
Well, 100%, because it doesn't... The two things... Well, in groups like ours, I know there are groups that have women in them. In fact, a reasonable percentage of the sales of role-playing games go to women. But in our group, it just could not have sustained that, because any girl that I ever brought into that group would have immediately been the target for ridicule, horrible practical jokes. And I can remember one of my friends saying to me when I got this girlfriend, oh, you know, you should bring her to this rock festival we're going to. And I discovered and read between the lines that what they were hoping to do was to attack us in our tent and kind of cover us in, I don't know, whatever they could dig out of the dog mess bin or whatever. You know, this would have been their idea of extremely funny. This is what they were like, these guys. You know, he's 2-3 years older than me. He said, you know, if you go to this rock festival, you'll be able to, And I was, what? You'll be able to sleep with her. And I said, well, we do that already. And his face kind of contorted into the shape of a sort of bright red walnut. And he just said, no, you don't. And I said, well, we do. And the next game I had, I was subjected to about 2-hour interrogation on what's it like, in order to establish whether I was lying or not. And at the end of it, they concluded that I was lying, because it wasn't exactly as one other boy had described it. Having said that, they were right. I was lying.
I should mention that, you did your job as a researcher in preparing to write this book. You actually returned to the Dungeons and Dragons table as an adult before, you know, finishing the book. How did that go?
Well, I've got a lot to say about this last chapter of my book, actually. It went awfully, and everybody that I went to this game with was depressingly exactly like the boys I'd played with when I was 15. I mean, this one guy, he said, oh, you're a writer, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, what format do you use? And then he kind of went on about computer programs of some sort. And I said, no, I'm a writer. I write books. He said, what, like on the shelf? And I said, yes. And he said, well, you've got a publisher. Yes. You can buy them in shops. Well, some of them, yeah. And he kind of balled up in on himself and just said, well, I think you will find that I am a consummate storyteller. And I was... yeah, mate, yeah, well, good. Well, pleased to hear it. So these guys, and there was the one who didn't talk, and, you know, there was all the rest of it. But having said that, obviously through this book, I've been in contact with a lot more gamers, and there are plenty of guys out there, and it is still largely guys, but there are plenty of guys out there who are perfectly normal and perfectly nice. But I think maybe I just have a bad luck magnet stuck somewhere where you can't see it on me. And, you know, I've since written a fantasy novel, sold it to a publisher, and yes, although no one will ever buy it because no one's interested in them anymore, I'm designing my own role-playing game again now. So, yeah, I went back to Mordor, where the shadows lie, at the end of this book.
Mark Barrowcliffe is the author of The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange, a memoir. It's published by Soho. Mark Barrowcliffe joined me from the BBC studios in Brighton, England. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me. It's been a delight.
Thank you.
My conversation with Mark Barrowcliffe about his book, The Elfish Gene, Dungeons, Dragons, and Growing Up Strange, will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be getting some expert help in previewing this week's NFL playoff games. Much good that's done me so far. And I'll visit with the only high school ice hockey team I know that depends on an 11-year-old goaltender. We'll have a story about the resurgent Chicago Blackhawks as well, and I'll be reading from your letters. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.